I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Many years ago, we took Radio Times to the Dodge Poetry Festival in New Jersey to interview poets for a live show. And I felt like I had been transported to the land of language, where words really mattered. It's also where I first heard Philip Levine read his powerful poem, What Work Is. And frankly, I can't get those words and his voice out of my head, and I'm not complaining. It's National Poetry Month, time for more poetry on Radio Times. Yolanda Wisher is here. She's Philadelphia's current and third poet laureate. She was Montgomery County's first when she was in her early 20s. Her collection of poetry is Monk Eats an Afro. She was a 2015 Pew Fellow and former art education director for the city's mural arts program. And Yolanda Wisher, nice to have you with us on Radio Times, and happy Poetry Month.
Happy Poetry Month to you. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us is Patrick Rosal. He's a professor of English at Rutgers University Camden in their MFA program. His most recent collection of poems is titled Brooklyn Antediluvian. He's a John Simon Guggenheim Fellow and has performed poetry all over the world. And Patrick Rosal, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well. And happy Poetry Month.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
Nice to have you both with us. And I have to say, I really am looking forward to having you both read some of your poems. Yolanda, you are the poet laureate. How have you been celebrating this month?
With lots of readings and workshops and traveling to educational institutions all over the area. It's actually been really busy. I've just wrapped up a festival of poetry in 30th Street Station, so that was a big chunk of my poetry month. But just the regular for, I guess, every poet in April is like
is your hardest working month,
yes.
How about for you, Patrick?
It's year-round for me, but April is nice because people are paying attention and I get to go to some extra places. I did the 30th Street Station reading about a week or so ago. So, yeah, it's been exciting.
I was thinking about Black History Month, Poetry Month, I mean, Women's History Month. I mean, we don't have a novel month. We don't have a memoir month. Do we still need, Patrick, do you think, a Poetry Month? Has poetry kind of sprung itself out of the ivory tower?
I don't know if it's sprung. Well, you know,
no.
It has a particular kind of life inside of the academy, but it certainly has a thriving life outside of the academy. And Philadelphia is a city that has nurtured poetry virtually everywhere in the city. So I think it continues to thrive in a lot of different places, and it's just a matter of who is paying attention when.
Do we still need a National Poetry Month, Yolanda?
Yeah, bring it on, you know, every year. I think it could, you know, it's, I think a lot of poetry still lives in the academy and it still hasn't touched as many people as I'd like. It's still not as accessible. I'd love it if you could walk into your laundromat and find poetry, or walk into your supermarket or the post office. I think of all the municipal services that would, you know, feel a little bit more like the honey of life if we added some poetry, you know.
Why don't we?
I don't know. Maybe because we, you know, as Muriel Rukeyser said, we fear where poetry can take us. You know, it plumbs the depths of who we are, you know.
Because it's potentially dangerous.
Yes. Threatening.
We
don't know what we're all
going to
say. Yeah. We don't know what we're going to say. We don't know how we're going to feel. So, but we're trying to document that, you know, that complexity.
You're nodding your head, Patrick.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think in terms of danger, it's that one of the things that poems can do is point to our inner strangeness and bring it out in language. And the strangeness is it's the energy of our imagination, and it's also the thing that brings us all together, is that small piece of us that feels a little bit outside of the normal. And poems do that in such a beautiful way, you know.
I mentioned being at the Dodge Poetry Festival, and I truly mean it was the land of language. And I'd never been to a place where everyone, I mean, the poets, poets were the main attraction. Yeah. And listening to these poets reading their poems, and just all of a sudden the words just meant so much. And yet out in the rest of the world, all that seems to get diluted.
No, I took students to that poetry festival for years as an English teacher, and my first time was as a freshman in college at Lafayette. I, you know, our English professor, Beth Seach, took us up in a little car me and Ross all went to, Ross Gay, another poet friend of ours, all saw that experience. And it was great to have poetry front and center like that, and to meet the diversity of poet voices that they collect at this poetry festival. I saw Lucille Clifton read there, and Jane Cortez with her band. Yeah. I mean, who knew you could have a band as a poet? Right. I mean, it opened up a lot of doors for me as a student, and also just as a writer, thinking about the possibilities of the voice that I could cultivate through poetry.
Interesting. And music as well. In reading a little bit about both of you, it seems like music has played a part in your life, but also in your poetry, Patrick.
Yeah, they're inseparable for me. My first dream was to become a composer and a musician.
Really?
I pursued it pretty seriously for a long time. And, you know, my folks are from the Philippines, and, you know, the immigrant mentality that you have to do something that's more practical sort of drove me away. My dad's family is a lot of really beautiful musicians, but none of them got to really pursue it. I came across poetry, and it was like I could make language do what I might make a guitar or drum or piano do. I'm essentially trying to make some music without a language, you know.
Poetry may be the most impractical job, don't you think? Well, I mean, really, let's be honest here.
It's hard. I mean, you have to be creative about the way you poet in the world.
Yeah, that's true.
But I think it's I love the freedom that it gives me, the freedom of voice, the freedom to move around in the world, the freedom to do something I love with something I'm passionate about. And I think, you know, we need more opportunities to help people find their own voices and then find out what they can do with it, you know? So...
Is there a moment when you, quote unquote, discovered poetry or had an experience with a poem?
You know, I had lots of those moments growing up. I think the first thing I think of is my mother's bookcase, you know, and the language of my aunts. You know, my aunts used to play pinochle and smoke Marlboros and drink, you know, moonshine, and they had a way of talking that was pure poetry for me. And it was unlike the Shakespeare sonnets I was reading in school or the Phyllis Wheatley poems everybody wanted to give me as a young Black girl writing poems. I wanted to find a poetry that can include the voices of my aunts, my great aunts, and the language of my uncles and the way we spoke in our home, you know. It was important for me. I'm still working towards that voice. You know?
Patrick, I was reading a little bit about you and about the fact that you were raised in a Catholic family.
Oh, very Catholic.
And a very Catholic family. Okay, I amend that. But just even scripture and ritual and all that of a Catholic service, how that has been an influence on you.
Deeply. My father was actually a Catholic priest.
Oh, wow.
So, he left the priesthood just before I was born in 1968. So we were immersed in ritual. I think that, you know, the holy season, Lent, and the Passion are sort of beautiful, beautiful rituals and ceremonies, and the imagery of suffering and the music. It's just so gorgeous. But like Yolanda too, in my poems, what I'm trying to do is fuse these sort of Catholic and even American traditions of poetry and liturgy and so forth with the rituals of eating together, the rituals of farewells. I mean, Filipinos export labor. And so there are rituals of farewell that are part and parcel of where I come from. All the, the mean talking across the table and, you know, the gathering, all those speech habits, I'm hoping, are informing the way that I'm making poems.
Mm-hmm. And for you, was there, I don't mean to over dramatize it, but I mean, was there a moment when you saw poetry as possibility for you?
It was later. I mean, I was not, you know, every year I talk with publishing professionals, and invariably somebody says, boys don't read.
Oh.
And
really?
Yeah,
even now.
So they, like book publishers don't try to, what they try to do is they try to sell to existing markets. They make books they don't think about the construction of markets. One of the things I love about what Yolanda has done as poet laureate is that she knows that literature lives everywhere. It doesn't just live where there's a market demand. Mm. And so, yeah, I mean, I feel like I missed your question.
No, that's okay. You took us on a really interesting tour, but it sounds like you're saying is that you were either late to books or late to discovering the books or maybe the poems that really meant something to you.
Yeah. So my literacy was – the literacy that prepared me was a literacy of hip-hop, a literacy of dancing, a literacy of Filipino culture. And it made me a very good reader of poems because I had to read so many different kinds of English and so many different kinds of language. So when poetry books were given to me, it wasn't that I was reading. It was that I was learning to read bodies. I was learning to read people. I was learning to read places. And that's an excellent education for learning how to read poems.
Yeah. I'm thinking about the fact that you both live in Philadelphia. Do you think there's also something about just living in an urban environment where it's noisier, you're going to hear more languages, you're going to hear more ways that people express themselves?
Yeah, I mean, cities are all about juxtaposition, you know, and all of that intersectionality, you know, all these people crossing paths. I find a lot of poetry in those contrasts, you know, the contrast that you see in a city, just in the landscape, the people. And there's so much to observe, you know. I like being the fly on the wall. I like riding the train and just writing and taking it in. And I like how just moving around the city, you know, helps me move around my life inside my head. Wow. You know, it helps me kind of always kind of go over again, you know, how did I get here? You know, where am I going? You know, Philly's been a big part of that. I mean, there's so many artists here. There's a tradition here. You can plug into it in a way I don't think you can do so in a lot of other cities. And people, I mean, despite what people say, I think people are very welcoming here. I think the artist community does kind of welcome you in. And, you know, it's a great growing ground.
Well, you're a relative newcomer, I guess, Patrick, to Philadelphia. You're the Philadelphia area.
Yeah,
you agree
yeah.
with what Yolanda said?
Yeah. You know, being in an urban space is you're constantly aware of the public sphere.
Yeah.
And the kinds of poems that I think that Yolanda and I are making and are interested in, they navigate this avenue between the public and the private. You know, the poems are trying to bring up something from the inside and bring them out, or observe the outside world and see how it corresponds to what our inner world is doing. And a city is great for that.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. And I also want to have both of our guests read some poems as well. It is National Poetry Month. April is National Poetry Month. And of course, a couple of days before the end of the month, we wanted to make sure that we did spend an hour really talking about the importance, the power of poetry. Yolanda Wisher is Philadelphia's current and third poet laureate. Also with us, Patrick Rosal. He's a professor of English at Rutgers University Camden in their MFA program. And we want to hear from you. We want to hear about the poems or the poetry or the poets in your life. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You can text or call our comment line, 267-405-2006. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We just found out it's Poem in Your Pocket Day. And we have two poets who have joined us for Radio Times today, Yolanda Wisher and Patrick Rosal. Yolanda, I'd love to have you read one of your poems for us.
Cool. I'd love to read this poem called Slow Drag. It's kind of an homage to my neighborhood of Germantown. And it opens with a line from a Bobby Caldwell song called What You Won't Do. I guess you wonder where I've been. As you and I drive to school this morning in complete silence, we pass a gas station on Queen Lane, and there is a man in a spotted jacket, fake cowhide, wearing gold gazelles on his eyes, dancing with a woman next to the pump. It is a slow drag, to a song only in their minds. Could be Pendergrass or Billy Paul, something straight out of Philly's Black Bottom. It's 7:45 a.m., and they are swaying next to a parked van, door open on the driver's side, as if he saw her walking down the street after all that time and pulled in to the station to fill up with her again. Young boys in black hoodies swagger past like lions without a tribe, trying to suppress a giggle that would give their hearts away.
Wow, I love that. Slow Drag, written and performed by Yolanda Wisher. You took us there.
I feel like to Queen Lane in Germantown, yes, at the gas station.
You saw this, as you said.
Yeah, I was on my way to work with my partner in the car, and I think we were having an argument that morning.
Oh, interesting.
Wow. And
that was the silent partner here?
Yes, that's in complete silence. Like, don't say anything else. And, you know, sometimes you just get reminded, like, oh, you know, why you're married, why you decided to partner up with somebody. You look out, you see what happens in a city, a scene of love. Mm. And then you see everybody else watching that scene, too, you know? And I saw some little boys just, you know, I saw some boys that I guess sometimes people would see as a threat and as dangerous in their black hoodies. I saw them in their tenderness, you know, and it did something to me.
Like lions without a tribe.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea that they saw what you saw they felt what
and
you
they
felt.
They felt something, too. You know, we all felt that love between that reunited couple, you know.
That's great. Well, I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Patrick, I'd love to have you read a poem.
Yeah, sure. I'm going to read a Scavenger's Ode to the Turntable, or a note to Thomas Alva Edison. If I could just say something really
Please
quick.
Do. That
Thomas Edison, as the inventor of the phonograph, of course, made possible in some ways hip-hop, because the turntable was such a huge thing. And I belonged to a DJ crew, and we used to take apart these turntables and put them back together again. Thomas Edison was also an imperialist. He was in favor of the invasion of the Philippines in 1899. Mm-hmm. And there's a great scholar named Christine Balance, who I just want to shout out, who does a lot of interesting work in that regard. Anyway, the poem, A Scavenger's Ode to the Turntable, or A Note to Thomas Alva Edison. We lifted the precious arm first, then the platter. We pulled free the belt and unscrewed the top. I didn't take shop or build a whole lot by hand, but I was pretty good with a knife. I poked the half-dull blade clean and gentle through the turntable's plastic. I sawed down 4 inches, straight as I could make it. Me and my boys, sons of cops, bookkeepers, and ex-priests, picked up gear other DJs didn't want no more. One prep school kid who just bought a shiny new mixer tossed out his 2-month-old Newmark, which we picked from the garbage and hoisted home. We harvested the slider from the rich kid's rig. I stripped the wires, tips, and soldered them to pitch contacts in a basement of a maple split in Edison, New Jersey. We were learning to turn anything into anything else. While our mothers played mahjong in the sala, and our fathers bet slow horses, and the government bombed Iraq, we learned to poise pennies on the cartridge head so the diamond stylus would sit deep in the vinyl's groove. A dance floor could turn from whining to riot quick if a record skipped when we spun back the wax to its cue. We stayed awake from noon to noon, digging out from crates some forgotten voice or violin to scratch. We juggled and chirped. We perfected the grind of a downbeat and dropped it on the bass line coming round, half trash, half hallelujah. Our hands cut Bach to Bambada and made a dance hall jump. We held one ear to the syncopated kick and the other to a future music that no one else could hear. Out of a hunk of rescued junk, we built a machine to mix the classics. We faded and transformed. We chopped up masters and made the whole block bounce.
Again, another beautiful poem. Patrick Rosal and the poem called A Scavenger's Ode to the Turntable. I didn't know that, or I guess I didn't know that about Edison and his support of what was done to the Philippines, which sort of gives it this whole other scariness.
Yeah, there's a lot of things sort of, I'm writing now some prose about Thomas Edison, and I'm also interested in the intersections between Asian Americans and African Americans. I'm interested in terms of the city also. But Thomas Edison made these short films. You can see them on the Library of Congress YouTube channel. He made these films of battles in the Philippines against Americans and Filipinos, Filipinos getting shot and killed, Americans ostensibly winning the war. The thing was that there weren't that many Filipinos here in New Jersey to use for those films, so he used black folks.
Oh my gosh, really?
So one of the earliest sort of representations of Filipinos was by black folks who had to pretend to be killed. Wow. The irony being that the 24th and 25th Infantries, which were all black Buffalo soldiers, were sent to the Philippines to kill Filipinos. Mm-hmm. So you find African-Americans sort of caught between these two things. So this, you know, there's a lot of this history sort of woven into a lot of the poems that I'm writing. And, of course, the irony of growing up in Edison, New Jersey, and taking apart the very invention that this imperialist made. So
yeah. One of the things I underlined here, in a basement of a maple split in Edison, New Jersey, we were learning to turn anything into anything else while our mothers played mahjong in the sala and our fathers bet slow horses and the government bombed Iraq. Yes. I mean, I just that just kind of brought me up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's the simultaneity, as Yolanda was saying, between the horror and the tenderness. And poems, speaking of juxtaposition, poems can make both those things happen at the same time. Mm-hmm. And,
it's great to be speechless on the radio. Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you. We are talking about poetry. We're hearing some really fabulous poetry from our guest. Patrick Rosal is a professor of English at Rutgers University in Camden in their MFA program. His most recent collection of poems is titled Brooklyn Antediluvian. He's a John Simon Guggenheim Fellow, and he has performed poetry all over the world. Yolanda Wisher is Philadelphia's current and third poet laureate. In fact, she was Montgomery County's first poet laureate. Her collection of poetry is Monk Eats an Afro. And again, you can join our conversation. Again, that email address, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, text or call our comment line 267-405-2006. Yolanda, I was reading about you for a while. I don't know how serious you were, but you were thinking about, you had a basketball scholarship to, was it Lafayette College?
Yeah, I come from a family of basketball players. Both my mom and dad actually met at Millersville College on the basketball court. So I was destined to be a baller. And my mother was like my primary coach growing up. And so I played from about fourth grade on and was MVP of my high school basketball team. And it was just by a freak coincidence that the coach from Lafayette was recruiting somebody from the other team, and I happened to have a 25-point game with a bunch of threes, and they could not notice me. And so I got offered a what they called an athletic, I guess, grant to go to Lafayette. And I had no intentions of going there otherwise. I had no idea that there was this amazing English department there. I was totally there as an international law major. That's what I thought I was going to do. And I was going to play ball so I could travel the world like Dawn Staley, you know,
wow.
I wanted to be like, that was my model.
Dream big, right?
And I got there and discovered that I didn't want to spend all my time at college playing ball and traveling on a bus, that there was an artistic scene there. I was really entranced by my English classes, and that was where I found a lot of joy. And that was one of those first crossroads that I had where I had to kind of decide on poetry, you know, and decide on this passion, you know.
Yeah. Is there, I don't want to make a connection where one doesn't exist, but for some reason I was thinking about the, especially performing poems.
Yeah.
I mean, that there is something athletic.
Oh, yeah. I still love that. Even like performing with a band, I think is like being on a basketball team. It's like your crew, you know, and there's moments when you're playing music and you're improvising where it feels like a fast break. Mm. It feels like a play. It feels like motion, you know, it feels like zone.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
And that energy and that adrenaline is totally transferable. And that's, I think that's, I'm glad I had that education as a musician alongside the athletic education, you know.
Yeah. And you're nodding your head too, Patrick.
Yeah, I didn't play a whole lot. I mean, I played some ball growing up on the courts or whatever, but my athletic training would have been as a breaker, as a b-boy, a break dancer when I was younger. And you know, that those ciphers are for real, because you know, you're getting out of the dance floor and you got to show and prove. And And it's also really, I mean, flexibility, strength, speed, and it's a performance.
Yes.
And so all of that was really important for me as a preparation as a poet.
Let me read some of the comments here. What type of poetry makes the guests uncomfortable? That's a great question.
That is a good question.
We were talking about that earlier, about poems, in a sense, being dangerous or potentially dangerous. What type of poetry makes you uncomfortable, Yolanda? Or does it?
Not much, I would say, because I've heard a lot of different types of poetry. I don't know if it's maybe annoying. You know, maybe not anything hateful or anything. Boring, monotone poetry. You know, that's self-absorbed. You know, like no one else needs to really be in the room to hear you read this poem. That kind of gets me a little bit, because I feel it's a wasted opportunity to connect. Or it's a little lazy sometimes on the poet's part. I feel like we should show up for the poem and for the people. You know?
How about for you, Patrick?
Well, I think it depends on the context. And, you know, for me, I'm actually trying to find the poem that makes me uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
So the
poem, to write the poem that makes you feel uncomfortable?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, so that poem, like, you know, I'm reading this on a radio program, and a lot of people are going to hear it, and you think that, well, he's got to be comfortable with that. But if you, let's say, you know, I walked into, you know, the Thomas Edison Museum, where people are sort of praising and honoring him, making him a kind of hero, and I think he's a much more complex figure than that. Reading this poem is going to be an uncomfortable theirs, and I think every poem has a space or several spaces where it encounters a kind of danger.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a thing that we're trying to do in composition and revision, is try to encounter a kind of danger that we can't quite see in the public sphere.
Yeah.
Another question, can we snap our fingers when we hear poetry? We like, you were doing that, Yolanda.
Yeah, I do. I think you should do something to respond, you know, make some noise like, you know, so we know that you're feeling it.
Yeah.
You know, I think poets, we want to connect. We want to know that the words are touching you in some way. And it is about the call and the response, you know? It's about us putting something out, and we need to know how you hear it. I think you can snap. I think snapping is kind of like the poetry slam, spoken word kind of tradition. But, you know, people sometimes just head nod. You know, sometimes they just give you a nod, and they're feeling it. Or sometimes people just lean in, you know? And I feel like I'm like a sponge for that when I'm up in front of an audience, that I'm totally open to what everybody in the room might be feeling and what notes, what words kind of strike a chord, what words kind of fall flat. You know, it's an exercise in revision too.
Yeah.
Often.
You've done slams. I know you did a Nuyorican slam. I guess your first?
A long, long time ago, I started with slam at college, and the Nuyorican Poets Cafe visited my school.
Famous.
With Bob Holman and Tracy Morris. I think Willie Perdomo might have been part of that group too.
Wow.
It was just an amazing, it was the first time I even knew you could do that with poetry, because I was a student of poetry, but mostly just American Lit, English Lit, the Norton Anthology.
Right.
And then the Nuyorican showed up and blew up the whole thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, they held a slam at the school, and I decided to enter and did a crazy poem with a silver backpack on and some crazy silver platform shoes. And Bob Holman, you know, gave me my award. And I won. I felt anointed, you know. That was my entrance, and I didn't last very long in the slam world, because it never really was for me about the competition and about getting a score. But I appreciate the energy and the platform that it provides.
Have you done that too, Patrick?
Very little, but I know the world very well, and a lot of people who've been through it are super dear to me. And, you know, I just wanted to say something about Yolanda talking about being a sponge for that sort of audience response. The people who are listening are helping you make the poem in that moment. That's the magic of performance, that they become collaborators in the language. Your body's just the instrument, you know, but all the energy in the room, and maybe even like today as we're imagining these people who are listening, it's like you all are helping us make this poem, turning it from this thing on the page into the air.
Let me read some more comments. An email from Janet. I have Tower of Poetry in my living room. Read one poem out loud every day. I'm grateful to poets. A tweet from Allison. Poetry taught me something difficult, special skills needed to understand. This was a turnoff. Guests are changing my mind. I sort of misread that. The idea of, and I think it's true, there is poets and poems still struggle to be heard. And perhaps there's that sort of old way of presenting them and being a poet that has hopefully is changing, gotten in the way.
I think Billy Collins has this great poem about, you know, people holding the poem down in the classroom and like beating the meaning out of it. I love using that poem as kind of an intro to poetry workshops. And Muriel Rukeyser says, you know, in school we're taught how precious poetry is. You know, that it's here for the ages, but we're not told how to use it. And I think, we need to, I'm sure there are great poetry teachers. We're sitting right next to one, you know, who make people fall in love with poetry every day. But I don't know if that's the majority of students and the way that poetry is presented. And I think, you know, there are some more creative, imaginative ways we can start to read and understand what reading is, you know, reading the poem to write, writing the poem to read. There's a lot more I think we can understand about poetry and language and play and fun and pass that on to young people.
I want to pick up on that after this short break. We are talking about poetry. We are hearing some poems from our guest poet Yolanda Wisher and Patrick Rosal. And again, you can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And again, text or call our comment line, 267-405-2006. It's Poem in Your Pocket Day. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowing talking with Yolanda Wisher. She is Philadelphia's Poet Laureate. Her collection of poetry is titled Monk Eats an Afro. Also with us is Patrick Rosal, professor of English at Rutgers University, Camden, in their MFA program. His most recent collection of poetry titled Brooklyn Antediluvian, and he's also a John Simon Guggenheim Fellow. He's performed poetry all over the world, and Yolanda Wisher is certainly perform poetry all over the Philadelphia area, probably beyond as well. Let me pick up on something you said earlier about just reading/writing poems. And I have to say, in preparation for the show, I did read your poems out loud. And I felt like if I didn't read them out loud, I wouldn't get it. I mean, I just wouldn't get that full experience.
You know, that was one of the first rules that Sonia Sanchez, one of my professors at Temple, passed on to me and insisted upon. And she said her teacher, Louise Bogan, had also insisted that that's how every poem revision starts, is reading the poem out loud. And if it doesn't sound right in your own voice, it may need some tweaking, you know? So I always start there with the orality of poetry. And I think, you know, reading poems aloud, I think there's some great programs out there to get kids to recite poems, to write their own poems, to voice that. There's something about hearing poetry out loud in public spaces that shifts not only the space, but also people's sense of the person reading and the subject matter. And I think that's a powerful, powerful thing to pass on to young people, that control of your voice, the power to create your own narrative.
And for you, Patrick, do you, as a poet writing a poem, do you work out loud? Do you work?
Always.
I mean, you speak those words?
Always. You know, it's a lot like music. It's real hard to try to write music on a musical staff and not actually hear it out loud. The poem is the same thing. And, you know, to sort of expand it conceptually, the human body is part of the ecosystem. And so when a poem is spoken out loud, we're honoring and we're being present in our own ecology. And so think, you know, right now we're thinking a lot about environmental concerns, but the body, the human body, the way that we interact with one another, the way that we sound is a part of our ecology and a part of our environment. And that way, poems are a heightened form of engaging with an ecology and an environment.
Well, let's hear two more poems. Yolanda, you have one, Outbound at 30th Street Station, 2017. Yes.
And this is where I'm engaging the ecology of 30th Street Station. Just when the radio host pushed the audio recorder towards me, the sister who had been holding court with her seven selves started circling the table, getting louder and more populated with desire to be acknowledged. I said, "Excuse me," too much exasperation, too much bougie in my breath. And she yelled, "You don't own 30th Street Station." And I thought, yeah, you're right. But I do own this conductor of a voice. And I do own this train of a body. And I do own this ticket of a soul. And I'll share it with you. But then she had to go and say, "And my voice is smoother than yours." The lights were already dim in there. Didn't need no more shade. But instead of cutting her down like slick bud sisters as me are prone to do, I imagine she used to be, was still deep inside, a girl who liked writing poems in the 10th grade, or a poet who stopped performing because a lover said she had no real talent. Hmm. Or a 40th Street jazz singer with a busted windpipe. Not a woman wandering through a train station summoning conversation from a Ouija of her wits. But better yet, a lost radio DJ whose voice had marked the day between hours like a church bell or an ice cream truck. Voice heralding your favorite song or the tune that takes you out your mind for a moment. That voice, that sultry intermezzo between commercials, kept you inside the nocturnal lines of the road. A voice we loved, but never realized how much we missed. And here she is, missing us every day, or at least our ear.
Mm. Another beautiful poem from and by Yolanda Wisher. And again, you know, I feel like I'm there. And this, again, there's a little HYY piece to this story, right?
Right. So WHYY's Kimberly Haas had come through to interview me about this poetry festival I was curating in 30th Street Station over the past 2 weeks. And so there was a woman there. I learned a lot about who occupies 30th Street Station, who really occupies 30th Street Station. A lot of folks who are in between homes and experiencing some degree of homelessness. And it looked like this woman was. But she also just in passing kind of walked by our little setup of a microphone. It was like, "I was a DJ once, and that ain't no setup." You know, she had things to say about our little, you know, our little show. And so it just got me thinking about how to empathize with somebody who was trying not to connect. Mm-hmm. And how did you in some way lose that connection? Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I love that poetry is a space to sometimes imagine a connection where there is none. You know, because I saw her later in the week and she was still not very friendly to me, you know. But I think she represents something very important about that space and about the potential for me, you know, my power and my privilege in that moment as a poet, my ability to connect. And I kept turning in my mind for days until I could write the poem. Like, why does she keep staying with me? You know, why is her voice in my head?
I mean, it's powerful. And it reminds, I think, anyone of sort of those strangers that you pass and you just wonder, who are they?
Yeah, Philly is full of them.
Yes, it is. Yeah. Patrick, you have a poem for us, Typhoon poem.
Yeah. 2009, I was in the Philippines. And at that time, Typhoon Ondoy was considered a 100-year storm. And, of course, just a few years later, Typhoon Haiyan came and outdid the damage and destruction. So I was there. This is a story that I heard that happened during Typhoon Ondoy in 2009 in the Philippines. Typhoon poem. The teacher can't hear the children over all this monsoon racket. The zillion spoons whacking the rusty roofs. The wicked tin streams flipping full-grown bucks off their hooves. Everywhere there used to be a river, there's a bigger river now. Every hard face on the block is sopping. Even the court where girls from St. Ignominious ran the roughneck boys off to play their own three-on-three in plaid skirts and church shoes for cash. Forget it. The whole city is a flash flood with brawn enough to flush trucks sideways down the Capitol's widest drives. The crushed tonnage bobs around a bit at the foot of some Spanish bastard statue before it stalls and pools on white church steps. Brute pilgrims, face it. Paddling dogs won't make it. So children got no shot. But quick thinking, the teacher lashes her students two at a time with wire and stray twine. She binds them across their breasts to trees and metal posts lining the streets half flooded. Walk no goddamned way, she swears. She won't let one little one be washed out, even if their wriggling makes their armpits bleed. They'll have to make peace with the vision of their uncles and neighbors' blue bodies bumping past before they fishtail out of sight. You can't wish away the deluge. You can't vanish the bloated carnage waters. But the tykes, in crew cuts and pigtails, still fastened to shafts and trunks in ragged rows, will survive. For now, their teacher has made them safe by building an orchard of them in the middle of a city road. This small chorus of young, hard fruit. This little grove moaning.
Patrick Rosal reading his poem, Typhoon Poem. Obviously so much in there. And again, you know, we're there. We're watching this. We see this teacher determined to save her children, her students. This orchard, an orchard of children in the middle of the street.
Yeah. I mean, it was something that sort of it cropped up. You know, the idea of an orchard being something about abundance, and but also the horror of you know, a human body turning into this non-human thing.
Too. Yeah, and the fact that she would lash one, knowing they could bleed, but they might survive.
Right.
Yeah. Very powerful.
Thank you.
Let me just read some comments, and I'm looking at the clock here, and I want to have two more poems as well. An email from Kathleen. She says, my neighbor displays poems in her window for passersby to enjoy. She changes the poems regularly, so there's always a new thought or inspiration. That's a nice neighborhood there. A tweet from Owen. Just finished attending a local poetry workshop run by a friend. The class reinvigorated my lost love for writing. Hashtag poetry. Email from Sherry. I treasure a recording of my grandfather, George Golson, of blessed memory as he reads in his warm, classical Brooklyn voice, Wordsworth's The World is Too Much with Us. Mm-hmm. My daughter is now memorizing the poem for her sixth grade class. And a tweet from Abby. Love hearing at Yolanda Wisher's powerful poetry and the power of poetry. So a lot of fans out there. I'd love to have you read another one of your poems, Yolanda.
So this is a love poem called Sonnet with Cooking Lexicon. We met at a fish fry poetry reading inside the food truck of life. I was pickling poems and poaching poets as the host. You walked in on a rotisserie spit carried by a pig roasted friend. I wanted to flash pasteurize you, peel back your pellicle, egg wash your livers, marinate you with Kahlua and miso, stick you in my earth oven for all eternity. That was a Friday. And there was some leftovers of you to baste and braise on Saturday. Your Bellican barbecue roasting and boasting in a casserole of adoration. The coddled kimchi of your affections down in my gut where family cycles were deglazed and dredged and curdled to a funky cheese you gladly dipped your cracker in. And this creaming and curing was what I signed up for. This runny sun and moon atop hash love. This wedding cabbage stinking up my ribcage like a sink full of chitlins. Boy, I'm in a huff pace bout you, day in, day out. Mincing no magic, reducing no reverence.
What a delicious and sexy poem that is, Yolanda. Thank Wisher. You. That's great.
Thank you.
And Patrick, you have one sort of in the food theme, Ode to Eating a Pomegranate yeah. in Brooklyn.
Yeah, which is also written after the end of love. So you got the beginning, okay. I got the end.
Let's do it. Let's do it. Tell the whole story.
Ode to Eating a Pomegranate in Brooklyn. When I fall in love again, I will have another heart and a second set of eyes, which is one way to watch the woman you love grow old. The story of my heartbreak started like this. Someone gave me a key that opens many doors. I traded it for a key that opens only one. I traded that one for another, and that for another, until there were no more doors and I had a fistful of keys. At any given moment, only part of the world is gruesome. There are three pomegranates in the fridge waiting to be broken open. When I fall in love again, my beloved and I will spit seeds into the street until the birds come to pluck them. When I fall in love, I'll count the tick of little pits in city puddles. I'll forget the dead and count the doors instead.
Another lovely poem. I love that image of the key and the door, you know, the keys and the doors.
Yeah, yeah.
Opening and closing, I guess,
yeah, totally.
In many ways.
Yeah, yeah.
We're almost out of time here. Yolanda, you are not just the Poet Laureate of Philadelphia, which I do want to talk to you about very briefly, but you're also the Chief Rhapsodist of Wherewithal for the U.S. Department of Arts and Culture. When I wrote that down, I scribbled under that, does Trump know?
Yeah, I'm actually the former Chief Rhapsodist.
Former Chief Rhapsodist.
Yeah, as of December. Yeah, I think Glenn Beck, when that organization was started, Glenn Beck riled about the U.S. Department of Arts and Culture and told everybody to keep an eye on us.
Oh, there you go.
But yeah, it was it's still going on. It's an awesome project. You know, basically a fake Department of Arts and Culture, the one that we should have, that would defend and advocate for the work that artists do. Wow. So it kind of models itself after an imagined future that we should have and that we all want. Involves arts and culture.
Do we need poet laureates? Poets laureate?
Yes, I think we do. I think it can be a symbolic role, but I think the way in Philly, what I love about the Philly tradition of poet laureates is that we are socially engaged poets who are interested in tapping into all the communities and the neighborhoods mm-hmm. here and helping people to find their voices in Philadelphia. So I think if that can happen everywhere, I'm all for it. I certainly think it deserves to be here.
Well, on that note, I can't thank you enough. I felt like I needed an hour of poetry. You gave it to us, and thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks for having us.
You're
Thanks
welcome. For making the space.
And Yolanda Wisher is Philadelphia's current and third poet laureate. Our guest Patrick Rosal is an associate professor of English at Rutgers University Camden in their MFA program. Each of them has certainly a bunch of books of poetry. Yolanda Wisher's book is Monk Eats an Afro. Patrick Rosal's most recent book is Brooklyn Antediluvian. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.